Well, thank you for the birthday gift you gave me last week. That was a real surprise coming early as it did. Thank you for your kind words and the generous gift. And I want to thank this class for one more thing, too. I mean, you're the guinea pigs for a lot of what goes on at Reasons to Believe. We've got some new material we want to test and develop and fine-tune. Well, we usually try it on you, and I appreciate the responses you get and the fact that you're willing to tolerate a sometimes relatively clumsy presentation while we get a chance to fine-tune it for a broader audience. Well, just to give a review of what we're going to cover this week, by the way, we did make an assignment last week of several scripture verses for you to talk about over lunch. If you've got something to share with the class, I'll invite you to come up. If not, I'm just going to jump right in. I'm going to leave another discussion question at the end of class today. But I'm going to look at the book of Daniel as it ties into the passage we're studying in Psalm 33. But before we do that, one new scientific discovery I want to share with you, published in the latest edition of the Astrophysical Journal, and it's all about black holes. And the discovery that black holes are a lot nastier than we thought they were by a good factor of 10. And this is because they've now got the telescope power to measure the spectral signature or the spectral response of cores of large galaxies. And for a long time, we were dependent on the Hubble Space Telescope to do this, but the Hubble Space Telescope simply isn't powerful enough to get sufficient sensitivity in the spectra of the core region of these galaxies that we can tell whether or not, well, we can tell whether or not there's a black hole there, but we don't have the sensitivity to measure the mass. Now, what has changed all that is the Keck telescope on top of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, 14,000-foot high peak, and they now have two 33-foot telescopes, optical telescopes. I mean, it's the largest telescope in the world, and it's tandem. They have, I mean, you got the 200-inch in Mount Palomar, which for a long time was the world's largest. This thing is 400 inches in diameter, and there are two of them side by side, so they can link the two together. And what's made the real breakthrough possible is they've equipped both of these 400-inch telescopes with what's called adaptive optics. You say, what's that all about? That's where they attach a laser to each telescope. And the laser creates an artificial star up in the atmosphere. And that artificial star tells them how the atmosphere is dancing and messing up the image. And then a computer is able to take away that atmospheric disturbance and give the telescopes a clear view. And so you get as clear a view as if the telescope was in outer space. It's as good as anything as in outer space. And it can be done for $250,000 per telescope. So now, put that in context. The Hubble Space Telescope, when it was launched, cost $1.7 billion. So for $250,000, you can make a ground-based telescope have images that are just as sharp as what you can get with a space-based telescope. Now, you still can't do ultraviolet observations. That's where the Hubble Space Telescope is preeminent. Because it's above the atmosphere doesn't block out the ultraviolet radiation, and doesn't block out parts of the infrared spectrum either, and therefore it's still important that we have space telescopes. But the Hubble Space Telescope is only 96 inches in diameter, so it really can't compete with these monster telescopes they have on the ground. But as it is, as this article points out, only the Keck tandem 400-inch telescopes with adaptive optics have the necessary sensitivity for the first time to measure the masses of supergiant black holes in the center of these big galaxies. And what they discovered is that those black holes are about 10 times bigger than what they thought they were. And therefore, it's much more critical that we be a goodly distance from those monster black holes. Now, every spiral galaxy and every elliptical galaxy has a black hole at its core. Now, our Milky Way galaxy has a relatively small black hole at its core. and only measures a little more than 2 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. You know, pretty massive thing. You say, how does it get that massive? Well, you know, you get a black hole forming from a supergiant star, and a supergiant star will probably kick in around 40, 50 times the mass of our star, the Sun. But when it ends its burning cycle, it will become a black hole. But if it's situated at the center of the galaxy, the star density is intense there. And so the gravity of the black hole every once in a while will suck a star into it. And that will cause the mass of the black hole to get bigger and bigger and bigger as time goes by. Right now, astronomers are watching some stars that are orbiting the black hole at the center of our galaxy to see if they will have the opportunity to watch one get sucked in. And if that happens, we'll get gravitational waves that we can see with that thing that's situated in Louisiana and the state of Washington, the Gravity Wave Telescope. Well, as this article points out, life is possible here in our Milky Way galaxy because we don't have any really big black hole in the center. It's only 2 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. We look at our neighboring galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy. That black hole is coming in at 4 to 5 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. Now, that's still relatively minor compared to the giant elliptical galaxies in the centers of typical clusters of galaxies. And what this article points out is that they've now come up with an accurate measure for the size of the black hole in what's called M87, Messier 87. It's a galaxy you can see with a relatively small telescope in the constellation Virgo. It's the second largest galaxy in the Virgo cluster of galaxies, and they've been able to show that it has a mass of 3 billion times the mass of the Sun, 3 billion solar masses. Now, the whole point of the article is to say that they've discovered a relationship between the luminosity of the galaxy and the size of the black hole. It's a tight relationship. So if they know the luminosity of the galaxy, they know how big the black hole is at the core. Now, what's a little bit alarming about this research is that M87 is not an extremely luminous galaxy. There are many other galaxies we see that are much more luminous than M87. And so as the article concludes, there's got to be a lot of galaxies in our universe with black holes that exceed 10 billion solar masses. Now, at 10 billion solar masses, you don't want to be anywhere close to that black hole. Do we have a choice? Well, the Creator had a choice. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is that, you know, one of the amazing things about our Milky Way galaxy is that it's in a tiny cluster of galaxies, a local group. I talked about that last week. We live in a very atypical cluster of galaxies. Your typical cluster has got 10,000 plus members. Our cluster has only 40 members. Your typical cluster has a few giant galaxies in it and supergiant galaxies. Our galaxy cluster has none. It's got zero. It's got two medium-sized galaxies and the rest are dwarf galaxies. The medium-sized ones being our Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy. Everything else is small potatoes. But that's not the typical situation. And as this article points out, the Virgo cluster of galaxies, although it does have more than 10,000 members, isn't especially rich or condensed in the structure of the galaxies. And so they said, you know, here we got a rather ordinary cluster of galaxies, and you got a second-rank galaxy in this cluster of galaxies, and even that thing has a black hole of 3 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. And so bottom line is, thank God we're a long ways from the center of the Virgo supercluster of galaxies. And that's the truth. The local group has only 40 members in it, but the really good fortune about the local group is that it's on the extreme outer fringe of the Virgo supercluster of galaxies, and our supercluster of galaxy tends to be relatively small on the scale of the cosmos. It's a rather tiny supercluster of galaxies, and the fact that we're so far away from that center of that means that we're well protected from the radiation of the black hole And by the way, as I said, there's a bigger galaxy in the Virgo supercluster than M87, and this paper tells us it's got to have a black hole a lot bigger than 3 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. So life is not possible anywhere near the core of the Virgo supercluster. Your hand was up first. Dwarf and subdwarf galaxies do have black holes, but they tend to be relatively small. Globular clusters likewise have black holes, but the black hole mass is measured in thousands of times the mass of the Sun rather than millions. But here we're talking about stuff that ranks in the billions. So, all right, your hand was up. No, it's not part of the missing mass of the universe, because being at the center of the galaxy, it's already accounted for. Yeah, because we can look at the dynamics of the galaxy and see that, infer that. And by the way, the textbooks need to be updated. We now know where all the missing mass is. So, but updated in the sense that a year ago, it was still true. We didn't know where all the missing... We knew how much mass there was, but we didn't know where it resided. But as of about 10, 11 months ago, we now know where all that stuff resides. So, pardon me? Spring cleaning 06. There you go. Yes, in the back. That's the Keck. Yeah, the Keck telescope currently ranks as the world's largest optical telescope. It's literally two 400-inch telescopes separated by, I think it's 1,000 meters. They actually use them as an interferometer. Right, yeah, if you watch the DVD Journey Toward Creation, they have me there on Keck 1. Keck 2 is under construction when we were at the site filming it. But Keck 2 is identical to Keck 1. No, they're both on the same mountain. The first one was already built when we did the video, and then the second one was under construction 1,000 meters away. So, all right, let me... Well, Keck 1, at the time it was built, was $40 million, which at that time was considered an enormous sum of money to build a telescope. But it all came at no expense to the taxpayer. The Keck, yeah. Mr. Keck funded the Keck telescope. Yeah, he was one of those awful oil men that made a lot of money, that's right. So, well, the amazing thing about the Keck telescopes, not only were they donated at no cost to the government, even the upkeep and the salaries for all the astronomers that worked there was also donated. So the entire research operation all comes from private funding. Well, it's tax deductible in the sense that the money he gives doesn't get taxed. That's correct, right. Yeah, right. But, compare that to $1.7 billion that the taxpayer to shell out for the Hubble Space Telescope, you get some idea. So, any more comment? Yeah, one more. Okay, Virgo is one of the constellations, and that's where the center of the Virgo supercluster of galaxies resides. Well, the constellations were star patterns that were put together by astrologers 4,000 years ago. And they wanted to tell a story to support their religion. And so they told the story with star patterns. And so they made up all these mythical figures with the patterns of stars in the sky and broke them up into these constellations. And that explains why they really don't look like anything that... I mean, if you look late at night, well, right about this part of the sky, you'll see a giant W-shaped constellation. And that one is supposed to be a woman sitting on a lounge-type chair. Okay? To me, it looks like a W. I mean... And the stars that make up the woman are so faint you can't see them under a Los Angeles sky anyway. You're doing well to make out her chair. There is one constellation that actually looks like what it's supposed to look like, and that's Orion. Orion is the hunter, and if you look at Orion, it really does look like a hunter. I mean, you can see the shape of the body, the knees, the feet, and the belt, and the sword that comes down from the belt. The one thing that's a little bit off is the head needs to be a brighter star. But other than that, it looks pretty good. Scorpio's not bad either. Scorpio really does look like a scorpion. That's one you can see tonight. Yeah, but it's not a teapot. I mean, I forget what Sagittarius is supposed to represent. I prefer to call it a teapot because that's really what it looks like. But the astrologers had some other... Yeah, they had something else in mind. So, yes.
Let's try to get back to the question of constellations. Is there an easy way for us to identify a place in the sky?
Right.
And constellations are made up of all the stars or galaxies or whatever else it might happen to be.
That's within that map, right. Yeah, so each constellation is kind of a map of a region of the night sky. And... you know, another good thing about our being so far away from the Virgo supercluster is we get to see the universe. If you're in a typical galaxy, the cluster would be so dominant in the sky you wouldn't be able to see past it. But fortunately, our supercluster only blocks out one small part of one constellation. That's it. So kind of one little region of Virgo, you look there, you'll see thousands of galaxies all jammed in one little spot. But it really doesn't block out much of the night sky, and that's just because we're so extremely distant from it. But that is unusual in the universe. Usually, anywhere else you go in the universe, you look out at the night sky, and you see a few giant galaxies blocking out your view of everything else. So, fortunately, that's not the way it is for us. Okay, let's jump in. We got a question over here. Well, when we talk about the missing mass, astronomers recognized some time ago that the mass that's easy to see and measure accounts for just 1% of the total mass that we know exists in the universe. How do we know that? Well, the other 99% you can detect by its gravitational influence. You can't see any light coming out of it. But you can tell that it's causing stuff to be gravitationally tugged or pulled. And so you look for those gravitational tugs and pulls. And the real breakthrough in trying to map all this dark stuff and figure out where it is was gravitational lenses. Einstein's theory of relativity tells you that if you've got a massive pile of, you know, pile of mass out there, that mass, whether it exhibits light or not, will bend the light of some other star or galaxy. And so, for example, your typical gravitational lens, you've got to see a quasar off in a distant universe, and you've got a lump of mass between your telescope and that distant quasar, and you can't see any light from that lump of mass, but that lump of mass will actually bend light around it. And so instead of seeing a point of light from the quasar, you see a circle. Because the light of the quasar is going to be bent like this around the mass, and you're going to see that circle of light around that dark mass. Now, it's not always a circle of light. Sometimes you see a cross where you see four points of light because you're not exactly along the line. But by that means, astronomers have now found enough of these gravitational lenses that we can determine in detail not only where this dark stuff resides, but what kind of dark stuff is responsible for the bending of the light? And so we have what's called ordinary dark matter, which would be things like rocks and pebbles and dust that don't emit light. Then you've got exotic dark matter, which would be things like neutrinos and axions and neutralinos that are really, you know, strange particles. They don't interact well with protons, neutrons, photons, and electrons at all. But they are distributed very differently. Now, if you want a quick summary of this, so where does all the dark stuff reside? By the way, that's a question God asked in Job 38:19. He said to Job and his friends, "Tell me, if you think you're so smart, where does the dark stuff reside?" Well, a year ago, we've been able to answer that question. Where the dark, it took us 4,000 years or 3,400 years, but we now know where the dark stuff resides. And what's exciting to me about God's questions in Job 38, every time we answer one of those questions, it gives us an astounding new scientific argument for the supernatural design of the universe for the benefit of humanity. I can tell you this, the discovery of the location of all the dark stuff in the universe gives us by far the most spectacular evidence for supernatural design. There is no better scientific evidence than the quantity of darkness and the location of that darkness. But real quick, and then we'll get into the Psalms. There's three forms of darkness. Dark energy, which is the most predominant. Exotic dark matter, which is next. And least of all is ordinary dark matter. The dark energy is distributed over the entire surface of the universe, and no matter where you go, it measures the same. So it's evenly distributed. There is no differentiation of the dark energy. And keep in mind, all the stuff of the universe is confined to the surface of the universe in the same manner that all the human beings on planet Earth are confined to the surface of planet Earth. So the universe is like planet Earth in terms of where all the stuff resides. Now, the ordinary dark matter finds itself in huge halos around the galaxies. So every galaxy, maybe think about our spiral galaxy. Around our spiral galaxy is a halo of ordinary matter, dust, rocks, and pebbles that are distributed in this huge halo about our galaxy. Say, how big a halo? Well, the light that you see from our Milky Way galaxy covers a diameter of about 100,000 light years. Now, the diameter of the dark matter halo is 10 times bigger. It's a million light years. And that's true of every galaxy. Every galaxy, including the dwarf galaxies, have these halos of dark stuff around them, ordinary dark matter. Now, the exotic dark matter are superhalos. They're halos that are 10 times bigger than the, roughly 10 times bigger than the ordinary dark matter halos, and those are distributed around the big galaxies and the clusters of galaxies. Not the small galaxies, but every giant galaxy and every cluster of galaxy will have a halo of exotic dark matter around it. And because of those halos, you can have stable spiral galaxies. Without those halos, all the matter would collapse into black holes, and life would be impossible. But because of those halos. And we do know how it is that the ordinary dark matter halos got established. One of you gave me an article last week about the discovery of the most distant and oldest galaxy ever found. And what they found in that galaxy was that it was erupting huge supernova eruptions all at once. Throughout this primordial birthing galaxy were about 1,000 really big stars, bigger than any star that exists today. They're all exploding all at once. And these really giant stars, say, how big are we talking about? Well, 200 to 300 times the mass of our star, the Sun. The biggest star that exists in our galaxy today is 60 times the mass of our star, the Sun. So these are much bigger stars. And when they explode with so much force, they blow virtually all the gas, dust, and rocks that's in that galaxy out into a giant halo. And because they blow it out with such force into this giant halo, then that means that the mass of our galaxy is not centrally concentrated, and therefore not everything gets sucked into the black hole at the center of our galaxy. And likewise, we need the exotic dark matter halo to be 10 times bigger than the ordinary dark matter halo to keep the structure of galaxies in such a fashion that life would be even a possibility. Now, it's not solved yet, and I think this will win the Nobel Prize when somebody figures it out, is how come the exotic dark matter halos are so big? Why are they distributed about the galaxies and clusters of galaxies the way they are? And frankly, I don't think we're going to have any clue of that until we figure out what particles make up the exotic dark matter. And so far, all we know is that neutrinos make up part of it, but just a tiny part of it. The great part of the mass of exotic dark matter, we still have no idea what's responsible for that mass. Yes. Okay. What I was saying was that everything is restricted to the edge or the surface. Well, again, use the analogy of planet Earth. Planet Earth has three dimensions. But we human beings and all the cities of humanity are confined to the two-dimensional surface of the three-dimensional Earth. Likewise, all the stars and galaxies, all the matter and energy of the universe, and even all the space-time dimensions of the universe are confined to the three-dimensional surface of the four-dimensional universe. So there's nothing interior to that surface, there's nothing exterior to the surface. And you know who said it first? Isaiah and King David. They were the first to talk about how God expands, continuously expands the universe, like one would expand a tent in order to live. And the value of the word picture there is that the reality of a tent is its surface, not its interior or its exterior. Likewise, astronomers today recognize everything's on the surface. But it's a strange surface because it has thickness to it. It's a three-dimensional surface, not a two-dimensional surface. But the universe has four dimensions, so, hey, it all works out. And time, yeah, time acts as a fourth space dimension. So when you take into account time, length, width, and height, you can consider it as four dimensions of space in terms of the geometry of the universe. That was one of the breakthroughs of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that geometrically there's no difference between the time dimension and the space dimension. So it makes for some, you know, strange and wonderful physics. Okay. But, again, I remind you, the Bible said it first. Okay, Psalm 33. The passage we're looking at is verses 9, 10, and 11. I'll start in verse 8. I'll start in verse 6. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, their starry host by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. So it's talking about the creation of the universe, how God created it by the breath of his mouth, by his word. Talks about how he formed the oceans and the continents. Verse 8, let all the earth fear the Lord. The word for fear there is respect and honor and consider what he has done. Let all the people of the world revere him. That more gets across the sense of the Hebrew word there. Verse 9, for God spoke and it came to be. He commanded and it stood firm. Now up to this point we're focusing on the physical creation, the miracles that God performed in preparing the universe and planet Earth for the human species, including the structuring of the black holes and our placement with respect to the black holes so we'd be able to live on this planet today. And making the point that God's in complete control of everything within the physical creation. But then it goes on to talk about human affairs. Verse 10, the Lord foils the plans of the nations. He thwarts the purposes of the people, but the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. So, and the principle here is if God works in nature in such a way that we recognize that he's firmly in control, how much more should we expect this to be the case when he's dealing with the nations and our human affairs? And last week I had you look at some passages in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 21:1, The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a water course wherever he pleases. In other words, George Bush is not in control of all the political decisions he makes. The Lord is the one that determines what kind of votes will be taken in the Congress and what kinds of decisions the executive branch is going to make. And then we look at verse 24 of chapter 20. A man's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? Or look at Proverbs 16, verse 9. In his heart a man plans his course, but the Lord determines his steps. Or jump back to verse 4. The Lord works out everything for his own ends, even the wicked for the day of disaster. And so we discussed last week this paradox that we human beings make plans in our hearts, we decide to do things, and we carry them out, but everything we do has been predetermined by the Lord. The Lord determines the steps. We make plans, we make decisions, but God makes sure it's exactly what He intends. In that case, do we have free will? We certainly do. Can God hold us responsible for the plans we make and the decisions we make and the actions we take? He definitely can. But He's still 100% in control and is predetermined before the universe was even created. Every thought we would think, every word we would speak, and every action we would perform, including even our wicked deeds. That's the point of verse 4. That God is even in control of the wickedness of, say, an Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin. Yes. It's true for believers and non-believers. Okay, those are the passages I gave you to discuss over lunch. Those of you who go for lunch after the class or head over to coffee next door. What I promised I would do this week is give you an example of how this has played out in history as exemplified in passages of Scripture. And I got two examples I want to share with you. But one I want to begin with is Daniel chapter 10 and 11. And a little bit of a chapter. Well, we'll just stick with 10 and 11. Daniel 10 and 11. And this has been a problem for atheist skeptics for many centuries. Why? Because in Daniel 10 and 11, an angel comes and visits Daniel and tells him precisely what's going to happen in the future of the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and the Roman Empire. And we're talking incredible detail. I'm going to read this text for you. You'll see the kind of detail I'm talking about. Who marries whom, the kind of intrigues they carry out, the battles that they fight. All this has been predicted in the future. And all this, by the way, happened exactly as the angel told Daniel. Every detail you see here happened exactly as it's recorded here in the text. Now, this is such a difficult problem for atheist skeptics that they claimed that this was not the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. That rather it was a Daniel who probably lived in the 5th or 6th century A.D., and, of course, he got it all right because he could read the history books and get it right that way. This isn't foresight, it's simply hindsight. Well, what overthrew that skeptical response was the fact that significant portions of the book of Daniel were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls and through radiometric dating were determined to have been written previous to 200 B.C. Now, a lot of the events I'm going to talk about here in chapter 10 and 11 clearly happened after 200 B.C., many of them before 200 B.C. But it's more powerful than that in the sense that if we're talking of Daniel that lived before 200 B.C., then the only Daniel that makes any kind of rational sense is the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. There simply isn't enough time to go by for, say, a Daniel writing in, say, 300 B.C. rather than 500 B.C. You know, Daniel probably lived somewhere in the 6th, well, we know he lived in the 6th century B.C. But supposing there was a Daniel that was writing in the 4th century B.C. instead of the 6th century B.C. Well, because of the proximity in time to the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court, there would be no way that the contemporaries of that time would tolerate such a fraud. They would know it was a fraud. because, you know, it was someone trying to pretend to be the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court, and you're only talking a couple hundred years or less of time separation, everybody would know it's a fraud, which is why the skeptics opted for the, say, 600 A.D., because now we're talking 1,000 years of time, and with 1,000 years of time, somebody might be able to pull off that kind of a fraud. But with 200 years, there's no way. In other words, all scholars, including the atheist skeptics, now acknowledge that this book of Daniel was written by the Daniel of Nebuchadnezzar's court. There's no other interpretation that makes any rational sense other than that, given the early date we have from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Which means that everything we see here in chapter 10 and 11 was recorded before the events took place. Now keep in mind, and we're going to look at this, Daniel was given this vision and recorded this message when the first of the Persian Empire kings took the throne. The text points out that there were four kings that ruled over the Persian Empire when the Persian Empire was dominant upon the face of the earth. He was writing at the time of the first of the Persian kings, not the last, but the first. And so he goes on and talks about what's going to happen to the Persian Empire. Well, let me just jump into this. And by the way, a quick announcement. My son, my younger son, is a drummer for a band. He's got a gig this afternoon. I've got his car. So I'm going to need to leave here at 12:24, no later than 12:24. So I'm going to ask you to let me leave at 12:24. I'll teach up to that time, but I'm going to zoom out that door and be gone, because my son needs to get his drums over to his gig. So it gets complicated when your children grow up. It's not. Well, and they drive. I mean, I figure, well, you know, we got three cars. I mean, I can't imagine what we can do with three cars. Now we're short of cars all the time. That happens. Okay. When I grew up, we didn't have any cars at all. So, Daniel 10. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, Cyrus was the first of the Persian kings to rule over a significant empire. And if you recall from the history, in fact, you could read a little earlier in the book of Daniel, Cyrus was the one that defeated the Babylonian Empire. So, and what's interesting about that is, here you got Daniel, prime minister over the Babylonian Empire. King Cyrus of Persia comes and defeats the Babylonian Empire. What's the first thing that King Cyrus does when he takes over the Babylonian Empire? He takes his prime minister Daniel and says, well, you did a good job doing this for Nebuchadnezzar and his sons and the kings that have followed. I'm going to make you the prime minister. As far as I know, there's only one time that's ever happened in history. At no other time was there a prominent leader like that of two warring kingdoms where he was a prime minister of both the one on both sides, yeah. So here he was ruling, ruling over an empire that was fighting the Persians. The Persians take over, and instead of killing him, they make him prime minister. As the text points out, this man had such exceptional capability, namely Daniel, that everyone recognized his talents, including his own enemies. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a revelation was given to Daniel, who was also called Belteshazzar. That's the name he was given by the Babylonian kings. Its message was true. By the way, this is a quick joke. You know what you call that thing there? It's not an overhead projector. It's a Belteshazzar scope. It puts handwriting on the wall. Okay. You can take that home with you today. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. The understanding of the message came to him in a vision. At that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. What was Daniel doing? He was fasting and praying. Now, not all fasts mean you do without food. I mean, what you notice here is he fasted from not food, but he said, I fasted from choice food. I fasted from meat. I fasted from wine. I fasted from lotions. I try to get my wife into this idea. How about if you go several weeks where you don't use any makeup? You could fast from that. I'm trying to get my sons to fast from video games, but that's not going very far either. But the bottom line is this, that why are the Scripture command us to fast? We fast so we can concentrate on prayer. That's what fasting is all about. You put aside your physical needs and wants, and use that which you put aside to really focus on spiritual communication. So this man, Daniel, was praying for 3 weeks straight. That's what he was doing. For 3 weeks, he was praying. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river. By the way, if you go back a little bit, it tells you what he was praying about. I won't go into that. I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris. I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen, with a belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, his face like lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice like the sound of a multitude. He was confronted with an angel, one of the higher angels in the system of angels. And an angel, if you're not aware of this, can appear in any physical form that the angel so desires. An angel can come to you in the form, we're talking a fallen angel, can come in the form of your dead grandfather. It can come in the form of a UFO. It can take any form that it so chooses. So here we have an angel that takes the form of a man. And Daniel's first response is thinking he's talking to a man, but by the description, he quickly realizes that's not the case. Verse 7, I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision. The men with me did not see it. So he's with several other men, but he's the only one that saw this angel. But such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. So I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. Then I heard him, the angel, speaking. And as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. A hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. He said, Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I am about to speak to you, and stand up, for I have now been sent to you. And when he said this to me, I stood up trembling. Then he continued, Do not be afraid, Daniel, since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God. And this is where we picked up that he was praying. Now, for 3 weeks he was doing without all these luxuries, but we know he was praying because what it says here. So the angel tells him, look, your prayers were heard from the very first day of your fast. We heard your prayers, and we've come to you. Your words were heard, and I've come in response to them. But the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me for 21 days. So this is the whole point here. As soon as Daniel started to pray, God told the angel, you know, go talk to Daniel. But he wasn't able to get there right away. So here are these 3 weeks when, you know, Daniel's praying and wondering, is anything even happening? That ever happened to you in prayer? You pray for several hours and say, is anything even happening? Well, the angel says, your prayers were heard from the very first moment you started to pray. And a decision was made to give a response to your prayers. But we were delayed. We were delayed 21 days. And why the delay? The prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me for 21 days. You say, how can a prince resist an angel? What's going on here? Obviously referring to the king of Persia. But as this text goes on, as we go, we're talking about angels fighting angels. Paul makes reference to this in the book of Romans, how there and Ephesians, how there are these angelic battles going on that we can't see. We don't fight against flesh and blood. We fight against powers and principalities. And this is the whole point here, is that there was a fallen angel who was trying to move the king of Persia to make some decisions. And so God sent one of his angels to oppose the fallen angel. but it was a battle that went on for 21 days, trying to. So in terms of what we see in Proverbs 21, verse 1, how the Lord moves the heart of the king any direction he wants, well, keep in mind there's a battle going on. I'm sure all of you here in this class are old enough to have experienced a few of those battles, where there's something within you that's pushing you to do good. Powerful angels. The Persian king resisted me 21 days. Then Michael, one of the chief princes, that is one of the chief angels, came to help me. Michael's called the archangel, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now that's an interesting insight right there. Here's this angel battling a fallen angel, a demon, trying to direct the course of the Persian king in a particular direction. And evidently, this demon was of sufficient power that another angel had to come and help. Michael the archangel had to come here. Now you say, why all this focus just on one lousy Persian king? Well, the text tells us why this was so critical. And what we see in the book of Daniel, if you want a quick outline of the book of Daniel, it talks about how these demonic forces are trying to get things back to the way they were in Genesis chapter 11. What was going on in Genesis 11? The peoples of the world gathered into one place and set up one nation. But a single government is a government that's going to lead to oppression over its citizens. And God, ever since Genesis 11, has been involved in antitrust legislation, working to prevent, working to make sure that no nation becomes so dominant in the face of the earth that it's able to dictate to all the peoples of the earth what they can do and what they can't do. And it's just like with a company gaining control over a product. If they get a monopoly over a product, then they're free to charge whatever they want for that product and lower the quality. I mean, that's what happens with monopolies. When they get a monopoly, they lower the quality and they raise the price. And who suffers? The customer. Which is why governments try to make sure that doesn't happen. Well, likewise, God's in the business of making sure that doesn't happen. So what we're going to see here in the rest of chapter 10 and 11 is how God sends his angels to prevent these empires from becoming completely dominant in the face of the earth. And that was the goal of the Babylonian Empire, that they would become the dominant nation and be able to dictate to all the peoples of the world what they could do, what they can't do. God saw this as a problem, and so he engineered things to bring about the downfall of the Babylonian Empire. In fact, if you read on this book of Daniel, it says that the Assyrians were the first to try it. The Assyrians under Sennacherib tried to dominate the world, and God put a stop to it through Hezekiah and others. You can read about it in the book of Isaiah. But with the Assyrians gone, the Babylonians tried to set up a world empire, and God put a stop to it. And now we're talking about the Persians. They're trying to dominate the world. And so God is going to put a stop to it, and basically raises up the Greeks to stop the Persians from dominating the world. But when the Greeks come, they try to dominate the world, and so God works out things to stop the Greeks from being dominant. That's what the story is going to be all about. But what I want you to see here is just the detail of what it describes here. And by the way, this is all referred to as the Book of Truth. And you're going to see that referenced here twice in the book of Daniel. So the angel comes to Daniel and says, I'm going to give you the Book of Truth. The truth of what's going to happen in the future and why God is going to send his angels to bring about these circumstances the way we describe. It's all based on trying to make sure that the peoples of the world don't become so oppressed that evil takes over and righteousness doesn't have an opportunity. Quick outline. Okay. Then Daniel, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there for the king of Persia. Really the demon that was trying to direct the king of Persia. Now I've come to explain to you what will happen to your people in the future, for the vision concerns a time yet to come. Now while the angel was saying this to me, I bowed with my face toward the ground and was speechless. Then one who looked like a man touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and began to speak. I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I am helpless. How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone, and I can hardly breathe. Again, the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength. Do not be afraid, O man highly esteemed, he said. Peace, be strong now, be strong. Some scholars have speculated that this might indeed be the second person of the Trinity, Jesus Christ himself, who accompanied the angel and it gave him the strength. It's a matter of debate. When he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, Speak, my Lord, since you've given me strength. So he said, Do you know why I've come to you? Soon I'll return to fight against the prince of Persia. Now that's when the Persians, having replaced the Babylonians, get the idea, we're going to do what Nebuchadnezzar tried. We're going to try to take over the world. And said, when a future king of Persia does that, Cyrus is one of the good Persian kings. But those who followed him weren't in that same category. He says, I'll return to fight against the prince of Persia. So soon here is relative. We're talking like 100 years into the future. He's going to return and fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go, the prince of Greece will come. So in other words, the angel is saying that God's going to raise up the Greeks to put a stop to the Persian goal of dominating the world. But first I'll tell you what is written in the Book of Truth. So now we see this reference to the Book of Truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince. In other words, we got Michael and this angel. They're the ones that are involved in trying to direct the politics of that era. And the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him. Okay, now we get the detailed prophecy. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. And that's exactly what the history books tell us. Each one got richer than the one beforehand, and the last one was the richest of all. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Now, this is God's doing. I mean, the Persian kings could have said, ah, forget the Greeks. I mean, and there was really no reason why Artaxerxes had to invade Greece. Greece had nothing to offer him. He should have just left the Greeks alone, and the Greeks were content not to mess around. He could have done all that. But see, this angel purposely stirred up the Persian king against the Greeks because he intended to use the Greeks to bring about their downfall. Okay. All right. Three more kings will appear in Persia, then a fourth will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. Who's that referring to? Alexander the Great. He's the king of the Greeks who comes and rules with great power. But look what it says in verse 6. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. So here's Alexander, who sets up this worldwide empire. You know what happened? As soon as he got it set up, he got sick. Some say it was the flu. At age 33, he died. And the empire did not go to his descendants. Rather, it was broken up amongst his four generals. Each general got one quarter of the empire of Alexander the Great. And so instead of having one nation ruling over the world, we now had four nations. And that was predicted here in the book of Daniel long before it happened. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Angels are not as restricted spatially or temporally as we are. We human beings are confined to length, width, height, and time. That's not true of the angels. But what is true of the angels is that they are dimensionally restricted. Only God has no dimensional restrictions. So the angels have their realm, we have our realm. Our realm is smaller than their realm. They have the capacity, the power, to come into our realm when they so choose, and to exit when they so choose. We're stuck in our realm. We can't leave it, at least not yet. So in that sense, we're lower than the angels. So they can come, they can go. But they are created beings, they are dimensionally restricted, and they have time constraints just like we do. But their spatial constraints are nothing like ours. So that's kind of what angels are all about. Okay. Now then, we got through all this. Now we're down to these four nations. And if you want to look at a map, one of the four nations was basically Macedonia and Greece, and little tiny pieces of what is now Turkey. That was one kingdom. And then there was a kingdom that was down near the Indus Valley, where India is, basically Afghanistan and the regions around there. The two biggest components of the four kingdoms, I got to end soon, is what's called the King of the North and the King of the South. And that's what this text is all about. The King of the South was the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt. And the King of the North was the Seleucid Empire of the Syrians. And the rest of Daniel 11 talks about the battles that took place between the King of the North and the King of the South and the impact it had on the Jews living in Israel. Because basically the King of the North and the King of the South fought over control of what we now know as Palestine and went back and forth and back and forth. And I'm not going to have the time to go into this. We'll pick this up next week. But as you go through Daniel chapter 11, it speaks in great detail about the different generations of kings and queens, how they interact with one another, how they attack one another, the victories and the defeats they experience. And again, hundreds of years before the things happen, and it tells you how it all ends. It all ends with the Romans coming in and said, look, enough of this fighting. We're going to establish a peace here. And the Romans basically took over the Ptolemaic Empire and put in check the Seleucid Empire by taking Syria away from them and basically pushing them into the region of Mesopotamia. That's what the Romans did. So, but the Romans are actually mentioned in here. It talks about ships coming from the west and putting a stop to all these back and forth battles between the King of the North and King of the South and basically saved the Jews from extermination. Yes. We don't know, because the problem is the last four kings all took the title of Xerxes. And so you got Xerxes the first, Xerxes the second, Xerxes the third. And the term you hear, Artaxerxes, that you see in the book of Esther, there's a lot of dispute. Is it Xerxes 1, 2, 3, or 4? We really don't know. So chances are it's not the fourth. Oh, yeah. Esther was definitely after Daniel. Because, you know, we have Daniel in the days of Cyrus and Darius. And Darius was also called Xerxes. He's probably, you know, he would be Xerxes the First. But, you know, it's like Nebuchadnezzar. That title got taken by quite a few as well.